Hello and welcome to The Review, live from Studio One here on Monocle 24, with me, Tyler Brûlé, and Gillian Dubias.
Coming up on today's programme, we'll hear what's been taking readers' fancies in independent bookshops in Munich, Copenhagen and Panama City.
This is not chick lit we are talking about. This is hardcore young women who write about the nasty business going on. It's nowhere near chick lit.
Sounds like a Danish accent to me. We'll also be listening to some new music from Russ Slater, owner of Sounds and Colors, a South American music and culture magazine.
And we'll be flicking through the pages of our favourite magazines with Penny Martin, editor of Gentlewoman magazine.
All that and much more right here in The Review on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Studio One here at Midori House. With me, Tyler Brûlé and Gillian Dubias.
Good morning, Tyler.
Good morning, Gillian.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon at this point. I have always set myself in a bit of an East Coast mindset when I'm doing this program. I don't want to say that I don't think people are listening to the program in Asia or Europe, but I always think of this as a program that I have people in New York in mind and elsewhere.
And I have to say that was a beauty. I'm so used to doing this show from London on a Saturday, but it was great last week in New York to tune in from New York early morning with my coffee.
And there we were, just down the street as well. I think it's one of the great things about taking the show on the road is we've managed to start to master things here in London. It does put you in a completely different mindset. It's even sort of the news rhythm in New York, because I did the program Monday, meaning the briefing, midday program, 7 a.m. New York time. Then the next day went and did Morning Joe at MSNBC. And it's just very different being, you know, in a different rhythm when the day is kicking off. And you see sort of the different agendas and really what's driving the news wheel.
And what was nice when we were at the fifth anniversary party at the consulate to find out how many New Yorkers are actually listening live in the morning to the show. So we do have that sort of international connection, which is...
Yeah, and I said the follow-up, and I'm sure people have heard enough about our trip to New York probably. but it was a good one, because also people relate to, I think, this brand, and not in a different way, but there are different entry points, I feel, in North America. We know we've talked about it before, which is, you know, perhaps a shrinking international news agenda is one thing. You know, whether you look at a program like The Urbanist, or if I sort of spin the dial in the United States, you know, the show that you do with Hugo, Section D, there is not that discussion about design on any of the NPR
exactly
channels.
I found the same thing, because people are so loyal to NPR, but they are responding to the niche program we do, especially design and architecture, I found, because that's what I was talking about, but they are responding to the feature programs we do, which is nice.
And any top finds in New York?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, it's a city you want, but it's a city you want to discover something. So I decided this time I was going to go head up to Harlem, because I've never been, and I do start reading about the new energy there. We had the most amazing brunch at a place called Red Rooster.
That's right, yeah.
And the chef is really interesting. He's Marcus Samuelson. He's Swedish.
Yes.
Ethiopian parents.
Yeah.
And
he used to have Aquavit.
Yeah, he used to have Aquavit.
Yeah.
And that was a mixture of kind of New York and Swedish. This new restaurant in Harlem really celebrates all the foodie culture of Harlem, mixed with Ethiopia, mixed with Scandinavia, and music, because it celebrates the whole neighborhood. And it really is something about, you know, the regeneration, and that celebrate Harlem as a neighborhood.
And the menu, and I guess the presentation, wasn't too tricky?
No, well, it's not what you'd expect from Sunday brunch in Manhattan. Without a doubt, it does mix Scandinavian. So you have Helga's meatballs on the menu.
Right.
And you'll have like coconut curried lamb.
Right.
So it's definitely a mixture of culture. But no, it was really good. It was beautifully, beautifully cooked.
But is it a destination within Harlem?
Yeah.
Or do you think also people are going there who live in the area, would you say? I'm not giving you a tricky question.
No, I was saying, when they say it is celebrating neighborhood, it's fairly upscale and upmarket, so you don't sense the local Harlem people are going there, other than the new designers and architects and music people who are buying up the old mansions sort of further north in Harlem. Mm. Yes, those. But, you know, it is a more sophisticated destination restaurant. But great music, great gospel singing on a Sunday.
Yeah.
And an incredible atmosphere that you get on a Sunday in New York. And then...
I think I was going to say one of the interesting almost friction that I found in New York this week, and I mean the U.S. in general, but is, you know, and it's the ongoing story of sort of the massive chains versus, you know, what the small independents are doing, and if you look at sort of, you know, what some of the big media players are up to or not. And then, you know, you go to favorite bookstores like McNally Jackson around the corner from where we were staying. But what's even closer, though, is just on the corner of, I guess, Lafayette and Spring, I guess. It's just, you know, this little newsstand which had, you know, every single magazine that you could possibly imagine perfectly displayed. I mean, they're not going to win any design awards, but there is that standard racking system that newsstands use in New York, which is that clear, you know, perspex. You can see every cover. Yeah. You can see what you're looking at. And they're also very good at also tiering magazines at floor level as well. So you can also, you get, you know, full facings of all of the things that are selling. And you have everything, you know, from, you know, the most obscure titles coming out of Germany. You know, you had, Penny Martin's going to be on the program today. There was Gentlewoman, front and center. And it's just, that's so exciting.
I tumbled across it as well. And I have two foodie magazines that I picked up there. But it's small. That's what was amazing.
And the best,
the space is small.
So it's open 24 hours a day. That was the incredible thing. I said, well, what time do you close tonight? Because I wanted to go and do a magazine run. And even Andrew said he got there. He was so tired when he got to New York.
Surprised we didn't all bump into each other.
I know. And he said, I was so tired on Saturday night when I arrived. And, you know, we just finished production. And I just ran around the corner. I just filled up a bag of magazines and, ordered room service, stayed in my room, and I said, God, you're open 24 hours a day. And I thought, that's exactly what we need in our neighborhood. We should probably sort of move on to do print, maybe in a, well, I don't want to say in a longer lasting format, but certainly in a bookish format.
We should. Okay, well, you're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24. We'll be back in a moment. Well, as ever, we start with a trio of bookshops from around the world to hear what's been selling well this past week.
And we're going to start in Copenhagen. This is the bookshop Politiken.
My name is Christina Thiemer Grønborg, and I'm the manager at Politikens Boghal on Rådhuspladsen i Copenhagen. It's by Danish standards, it's a quite big place. We have everything from cookbooks to traveling books to music books. Fiction, and the whole place is owned by a newspaper called Politiken, Department of Publishing 2. The best sellers in Politiken right now are we have a lot of young Danish women who write about their bodies and their sexuality, and we are just throwing these books out there. And it's also the books we have in the windows. Some of the authors call, there's Olga Ravn, and there's Josefine Klaugard. Helle Helle is quite big, and Katrine Gyllenbrunn. This is not chick lit we are talking about. This is hardcore young women who write about the nasty business going on outside and around and in their bodies. It's nowhere near chick lit. Women who tells us about their pain, and it's more disgusting and maybe not so angry as the feminism was in the 70s. I think they hurt more. There are some mixed windows with a lot of titles in English and Danish, and then there are a cookbook, and then we have the young women. One of the cookbooks is called The Best Diet in the World. Don't know if it is, but it's in the beginning of the year, and people are really, really interested in losing weight. In this house, we have the publisher department. They have a best-selling crime writer called Jussi Adler. He's translated to English as well, and he's coming out with something. We hoped it will come in May, but it looks like we have to wait until the summer. People are waiting, and I know all the whole house is waiting on this. It's the same as we see in Sweden and Norway, and with the detective, just like you know them.
That was Christina Thiemer Grønborg from the Politiken bookstore in Copenhagen. I'm actually surprised she didn't talk more about all of the crime titles. I was over in Daunt the other day, and there are even you know, Japanese, you know, as I say, like new Japanese detective series that they're introducing, and everyone is sort of, you know, the Stieg Larsson, the Sara Lund of Japan suddenly.
Exactly, and with a name called Politiken, you know, I was expecting The Killing and a bit more relating to all that.
It's the other funny thing about that as well is, you know, there's another new series I think on ITV, and there's I think that series Borgen is on the BBC. Mm-hmm. running at the moment. And so you've got all of these kind of crime series, you know, running from Scandinavia. And you could, you know, with a crime series in America, it's fine because there's 300 million people. So you think, okay, well, you know, a couple of people die every week. It's not a big deal. But, you know, there's only 5 million people or 6 million people. There's not going to be anyone left if Sarah Lund doesn't work harder. Anyway.
The role of fantasy in fiction. All right. So next up, we are going to head to Panama City and visit Excedra Books.
My name is Sheila Terán. I am the owner of Excedra Books. We're located on Vía España. Vía España is one of the main streets of Panama. We opened our doors to the public on the 1st of February in the year 2001. So we're now just 11 years old. I think at first sight we have for people to see which are the newest bestsellers in Spanish and English, both languages. Well, right now we have Steve Jobs's book and the latest, and that's probably we're down to the last of the ones that we have here. Also the ones that are the big sellers in the States, the George Martin books and the Dork Diaries and the Stieg Larsson books. I read that series and I could not put any of those books down. That was fantastic. You don't get those all the time. Those come, and then it'll be a while until another one comes along that will be that much of a grabber. These, I think, I just got these in Robin Wasserman. I mean, they had very good reviews. You know, The Frozen, Shattered, Torn. It seemed like it would be an interesting book for the young people. This one on the Redeemers, these are all about Latin American leaders. And that's something that I think the people here in the area might be interested in looking up. Enrique Kraus. Redeemers, Ideas and Power in Latin America. And as we come through a little bit more, we have some very comfortable chairs where people can sit down. The idea is for them to be able to look through the book and see if they really want to purchase it. This is something that is novel here in Panama because when we first opened, people would look at the chairs and never sit down. But now some actually come and read the whole book here. But the idea is that for them to just glance through the book and see if that's what they really want to take. It's an uphill, complete uphill battle. But I'm stubborn, and I think we're improving a little bit year by year. We're now getting more involved with the schools, getting more involved with reading comprehension, and which is one of the basic problems why people in Panama are not big readers, because they just don't comprehend what they're reading. Well, I think it was the first few months that we were open. We had a customer who came in, and she selected about $1,500 worth of books, very pretty books, and she took them. But much to our surprise, just a few days later, she came back with all the books, and we asked, well, why was she returning them? Well, she had only used them so that they would look pretty on her bookshelves when she was having a party in her home. And she had absolutely no more need for the books. She was not a reader. She was just looking for pretty books. Panama used to be one of the best read countries in all Latin America, and it's become one of the worst. But it's very sad, and I'm hoping that we're making a change so that slowly but surely we're going to be getting readers back, and I think there's hope. And if we can just get them all focused in on reading, all children, I don't care what level of economic level, when you get them into books, they all deep down really enjoy reading. It's giving them that opportunity.
And that was Sheila Jean from Excedra Books in Panama City.
And now we're going to jump to Munich, and we're going to visit the Hohenzollernplatz Buchhandlung and hear what they are selling this week.
I will tell you something about my little bookstore in Schwabing in Munich. I'm very proud of this store. I have regular customers. The university is not far away, and I'd be lucky to have this bookstore not directly at the street. We are a little place with trees. The children can play outside. And I sell mostly literature, poor literature, for little children, for adults, for young people. And I'm working here since 10 years. It's my bookstore, and I'm very proud of it. The window display is my decision. Of course, I will show the people books I like very much, And also I like show people books which I suggest that they will like very much. When people come, they see, oh, this book I know, but the other one, I never heard of it. A few weeks ago, a book came out written by Joachim Gauck. This book, the name of the book is Freiheit, Freedom. And for me, it was very interesting to read it. Joachim Gauck lived in the German Democratic Republic, and he was one of the leader of the opposition in the German Democratic Republic. I was very happy when I learned that Gauck became candidate for Bundespräsident. I think it's a democratic thinking person. It's a very good man. I know him from childhood because I was born in Rostock and he was the friend of my daddy. They studied together theology, and he was very often, he visited us very often. And I loved him when I was a child because he was at any time kindly with us. He treated us kindly. He treated us like persons, not like childs. And that I loved. Okay, and that book will be printed, and 2 days later, this person will be probably Bundespräsident. That's, yeah, that's great. A book we are all looking forward to is Sunset Park, written by Paul Auster. Werner Schmitz translated it into German, and it will come in summer, in July. And I'm very sure that My Customs will love this book. My Customs read always. They read always Paul Auster. And yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
And that was Ruth Zeranka from the Hohenzollernplatz Buchhandlung in Munich. I want her to open a branch around here as well.
Exactly. I mean, there's a woman who knows, loves her books, and has an opinion.
Exactly. And you better like what she has on offer. And I like, and I do like the fact that she does the visual merchandising.
Absolutely.
As well. Did you go into? I just went back to McNally Jackson in New York. Did you see they've got their little bespoke printing press?
Yes. Well, we did a little film on that for the
but
briefing.
I've never seen it functioning.
Yeah. No, it's quite therapeutic.
Yeah.
It
just sort of, yeah, and just like watching like the books trimming and you know, I think that side of technology is interesting, and that they're still putting ink on page. Anyway, we're going to head to the Midlands via Columbia, via the sounds and colors of the magazine with Russ Slater right after this.
The Menu is Monocle's delectable food and drinks program with me, Markus Hippi. On the menu, you'll find out about delicious edibles and mouth-watering drinks. We traverse the globe in search of the pioneers, making a stir amongst the food connoisseurs. We hunt down the wonderful and sometimes weird tasty trends that are making a buzz in the food industry.
We've been sort of traveling and collecting stories and collecting projects. So one of the things we hope to do is to connect all these narratives across these different geographies.
Milan to Tokyo, Buenos Aires to Auckland. Each week we send our correspondents to the far-flung corners of the world. We pop into independent bakeries, butchers and wineries to find people passionate about what they make. From French cheese to Bulgarian wine, from Japanese chocolates to South African caterpillar snacks. The Menu premieres every Friday at 1900 hours GMT. Join us for a drink where everything is on the menu.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug. With a team of 25 dedicated correspondents and bureaus in Zurich, Tokyo, Hong Kong and New York, Monocle 24 keeps you fully informed on events around the world, around the clock.
For Monocle in Caracas, I'm Sarah Granger.
For Monocle in Abu Dhabi, I'm Christopher Lord.
For Monocle in New York, I'm Aisha Spears.
For Monocle in Tel Aviv.
In Sao Paulo.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Manama. In Paris.
In Ramallah.
For Monocle in Hong Kong, I'm Liv Levichnik.
Bangkok.
Los Angeles.
In London.
Buenos Aires.
In Bogota.
In Toronto.
In Laetitia.
Keeping an eye and an ear on the world. This is Monocle 24.
And you are back with The Review with me, Tyler Brulé, and Gillian Dubois here in Studio One at Midori House.
It's time now for our weekly music review, and today our focus is on Colombia. Joining us on the line is Russ Slater, editor of Sounds and Colors, which is an online magazine dedicated to the South American music and culture scene. Welcome, Russ.
Hello.
Hello. We're calling you in the depths of the Midlands in the UK, but you've just come back from a month in Colombia. What was your mission there?
Well, my mission really was to discover as much music as possible, and also follow up a lot of music I'd already heard, but kind of wanted to hear it live and interview a few of the guys who'd made it. So
why Colombia?
Really, I went to the main cities. Maybe there's five big cities there, really, and each one's got its own music scene. So there's like Bogota, Cali, Medellin, Cartagena, and Barranquilla, like I say, each one of these has got all kinds of different music going on, which is completely different from the city before.
Now Russ, you've got a couple of discoveries. I'm looking just on the lineup here. We want to maybe start with something that's called Tambo by Herencia de Timbinqui. Sorry for butchering that. Maybe just tell us a little bit about the artist first.
Okay, yeah, sure. Well, this is, so it's Herencia de Timbinqui. And Timbinqui is a little village on the Pacific coast of Colombia, and this song is really representative of the Música Pacífica, which is the music all across this region, really, which kind of has a real relation, I guess, with African music. You've got the really traditional stuff would just be drums, vocals, and the marimba, and these guys are kind of taking it on a level forward, really, and using kind of trumpet sax. They've got a proper drum kit, and kind of trying to fill it out a little bit and making it, I don't know, I think they're doing something quite interesting with it, really, but kind of in a different way. There's some other groups who do something similar but bring in salsa influences and reggae influences, but these guys kind of keep it traditional, keeping the marimba at the front, really, and it's really nice.
Great. Okay, well, why don't we have a listen? This is a Tamba by Herencia de Timbi. And that was Tambo by Herencia de Timbiqui. That it's amazing listening to that, Russ, because, you know, if I didn't know better, I could have been listening to something from the other side of the Atlantic quite easily.
Yeah, no, for sure. Well, I think there is that real similarity, you know, with Western African music, where they have the same with balafon, which is like their marimba, and they have the drums and vocals as well. But you know, it's really interesting because it all comes from just one kind of free slave settlement from that side of Colombia, but there's I don't know, I think there's definitely some kind of Spanish influences creeping in there as well with the I don't know, the use of the brass and guitar and so on. But
so Russ, does this music travel across South America? Is it really quite contained to Colombia? Is there some, you know, crossover?
Well, this one actually, the Música Pacífica is really just in Colombia at the moment. I mean, the one interesting thing actually is that there's quite a few people in America and in Europe have actually been picking up a little bit of it, and there's been some remixes of these kinds of groups, really, which has been over the last year or so. So it's something that might kind of cross over, but yeah, in terms of South America, it's just really in Colombia.
You've got another one that you've lined up for us, which is a Cumbia Computer by Pernet. Tell us about them.
Okay, well, this is just really a singer called Humberto Burnett, and I don't know, I just really like this guy. Basically, he uses a lot of traditional influences. So on this one, the main kind of lead melody is from a gaita, which is a kind of a very traditional flute from Colombia. But then he uses a lot of electronic influences as well, and I don't know. Again, I think this one's probably representative of what's happening in Bogota, where you have kind of a lot of electronic music, but really really using a lot of traditional influences as well.
Okay, well, let's have a listen. This is the Cumbia Computer.
Cumbia Computer.
And that was Cumbia Computer by Umberto Pernet. And we're chatting to Russ Slater. Russ, we'd love to have you in studio when we can get you out of the Midlands.
Okay. Well, I need to... Now, I'll be back down in London soon, but I always find that there's too many distractions, especially of a Latin American nature in London. So
yes, this is very true. Away. But at least you have to come through. I don't think there's a lot of direct flights from Birmingham to Bogota or elsewhere. So we look forward to seeing you. Russ Slater, thanks very much.
No problem.
Thanks
for having us.
You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24. Up next, we're going to be going through our big stack of magazines with Penny Martin from The Gentlewoman. Back after this.
The Urbanist is a show about the cities we live in, and it introduces you to the planners, thinkers, and architects who want to make urban life rattle along like a well-tended tram, not grind to halt like a taxi with a flat tire.
We see that our community is changing, and we have two alternatives. We could make it an eyesore in the community, or we could make it a shining jewel, and we chose to make it a shining jewel.
Leave the countryside to the softies, and listen to the show that knows that a bit of grit and bustle is good for you. That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back. It's Saturday and you're listening to The Review with me, Gillian Tobias and Tyler Boulay.
And every Saturday here in Midori House, we pick some of our favourite magazine titles to rifle through. And this week we have the wonderful Penny Martin from The Gentlewoman here. Welcome, Penny.
Thank you. Hi, good morning.
I was just saying we were in New York and we were talking about rattling around all of our favourite newsstands. I do think that New York does the best newsstands in the world. I'm always amazed how these just the most niche and the most random neighbourhoods that you can still get the best international buffet as well of titles. There's such a good distribution system, and we need it. We need it more places in London. Of course, there's some good pockets of it, but it's the display in New York they get right.
It's true, and I certainly enjoy the sight of our magazine emailed back to me on those newsstands particularly. They're definitely the images that you email around to your parents, for instance.
Yeah, exactly, that you're not being a layabout. Well, I have to say that very hard to miss the new cover of The Gentlewoman. We've gone for... I guess you would say a fuchsia. I'm not sure if it was if it was a L'Oreal or or Chanel color, what it would be if it was a lipstick.
I believe it's called rhodium red but it certainly is pink, isn't it?
Absolutely, really great issue. I guess we can sort of we'll talk about your title first. Get all the flattery out of the way.
But, yeah, that's.
I guess what are you most proud of? And I guess the mission of this issue as well in terms of evolution, because this is number five.
Yeah, it's true. When we started the magazine, I remember my colleague Jop van Bennekom, who's the creative director, telling me, "Oh, you'll really feel that the magazine once we're at issue five," which is kind of slightly backhanded promise because it kind of felt like therefore there was a mountain to climb. But I understand what he means now, in that you just have a chance to try out a few things, and certainly with any luck, your magazine's grown. I mean, we're 40% bigger this time, so it does feel huge in comparison with the kind of comparable pamphlet that we made in issue one. And therefore, there's just many more branches to the tree, and you can try a few more experimental ideas with the layout, etc. But it just feels a bit more confident, I think, and certainly past the pink, inside there's a kind of just a bit more muscle, maybe.
Well, I think that there's a certain confidence, yes, that comes with you know heft, and for clearly, I mean, you know, the first few issues I think felt that way as well. But a little bit of volume is always a good thing as well.
Yeah. Well, you certainly know that. Then therefore, you can kind of maintain it. You know, when I used to love when we started, and people would say, "Oh, I love your magazine. There's not so much." You know, there's not too much advertising. You're like that. Look, we need advertising. You know, kind of people that don't make magazines don't realize that, you know, it's not sort of an option. You know, you're not going to sustain yourself if you don't have something. So it's all about balance, of course. And if people feel like they're reading a magalog, or they're just reading one of those magazines that's just pure advertising or advertorial, then yeah, that's obviously a disaster. But, you know, if people are really enjoying it, and, you know, it's a great period for me to be involved in, because just, you know, it's on the up, and everybody's really excited about it. So yeah, lucky me.
So looking back at issue one and now at five, you know, how are you trying to sort of evolve it, and what's changed, and where are you heading next?
Well, certainly since it's such a personality-centred magazine in terms of the subject matter, you've got a massive long list of women that you just love, and you know, in your first couple you hope you're going to get a few of them, but by this stage you're getting offered people that you'd never have dreamed of. So, you know, to have had Christy Turlington and Sinead O'Connor and Tilda Swinton and the amazing artist Lucy McKenzie, who I've had a massive crush on since, you know, I was in my late teens, and I used to see her on the television, you know. So it's just that feeling of ticking off every single woman and suddenly knowing that there's much more opportunity. So I think that's perhaps the kind of best thing about it.
I wanted to just ask about just the lineup of women. I mean, this is, give us the full rundown of everyone who's in the well of the book.
So oh, God.
You've got Christy, you've got Tilda.
There's Martha Lane Fox. And then it's interesting you say well, because they're not necessarily all collected together. We tried to break open the structure a little bit this time. So we've also got Maria Sharapova, the world's highest paid sportswoman, did you know? And Nina Flohr, who's the creative director of Europe's biggest growing private jet firm. We've got in the front section of those kind of Q&As, we've got Brix Smith Start and Helen Mountfield, who's Britain's leading woman QC. You know, there's a real mixture of quite different kinds of women, and that's the best thing about it, I think.
The balance, because, you know, you could have someone like Sharapova in the mix, and I'm wondering, how international do you keep it? Because, you know, then there is still something which is of a little bit of this island to it as well. And do you find that that's a bit of... that you want to have that friction as well? So, because if you pick this up in, you know, in Auckland, or you're buying it in Sapporo, that you feel that there's, you know, by way of introduction, you want to, you know, you want to bring these people up to the world stage.
Yeah, well, certainly the ambition is international, but it's true that I think a magazine's got some authenticity when you have something of your own, and you can trust your choices most of all with the people that you actually know, and you know why that TV star is kind of fun as well as a bit camp and a little bit, you know, mass. Whereas if it's an American TV star, you just don't know how the home audience feels about them. Sometimes it's nice to do somebody that, you know that you love them because they're Australian and you've got that sense of them. You know, a home audience would never feel affection for them. But yeah, it's hopefully a balance. But I do love being able to kind of remind people of people that they've always been loving in their home country, but they've kind of forgotten to feature. It's so easy to get into the kind of obvious trail of people that are pushing their new film and the new album. And then you end up with a very particular type of women. And I love, you know, old favourites and kind of women that just, you know, we're trying so hard for certain women, you know, the Joanna Lumleys of this world, and Oprah, please, one day. You know, and, you know, you might not have thought that they would be on a, you know, an ambitious woman's title, but I think it's important that they are, you know.
Well, that's a good point. How much do you have to play the PR game? Okay, you mentioned Oprah, and I mean, do you sometimes wonder, does, you know, I mean, hopefully that this, you know, that there's people at O Magazine, you know, in New York who love the gentlewoman.
They tell me they do.
I'm wondering how, you know, because, you know, you're not one of the obvious titles, and, you know, you don't have sort of, you know, the mass, and I'm sure
no, we're independent.
Yeah, and you know, you can imagine that lots of, you know, publicists are only looking for the, you know, the two or three big hits around the world. But have you actually found it quite easy, just because you're not asking the obvious question? It's not going to be the same old photographer.
I think that once they see the magazine, they realise that they're not just going to get half a page, and they're not in a kind of a sea of media content. That once, I mean, it's maybe a good and a bad side to it, in that once that we've got our claws into them, they're with us for 6 months and they are interviewed to death, and they have to come back with many layers of additional information. Like with the Tilda interview, I went to see her in Scotland and we saw her in London, and then I wanted her personal photos of her hometown, and, you know, they never really get rid of us. But the benefit of that is that it's an incredibly definitive, well, I hope at best, it's an incredibly thorough piece, and it's got kind of warmth and a kind of personal affection that you build up for the person. And by the end, you know, you really feel that you've established a relationship. Of course, that's a bit of an illusion in journalism, that people think, you know, journalists think that the subjects are their friends. But I hope that there's a sort of sense that it's a kind of party with all your favourite friends at the magazine. I think the best magazines are, aren't they? It's like the party you wish you'd been invited to, you know.
I mean, reading through these, I mean, the depth you go into, they're great social histories and of the now. I mean, do you ever get a sense that you'd like to revisit? I know it's a long way ahead, but 5-10 years, kind of revisit some of the same people?
Well, that's an interesting question, because that's something Fantastic Man are doing this issue. They're going back to somebody that they did before and doing them in a different way. And to begin with, I thought, oh, I'm not sure about that. But you realise, you know, that... it's just a different stage. And in fact, I used to do life story interviews for the National Sound Archive, which is held at the British Library, and they quite often do updates, and they're incredibly valuable because, of course, people regard their life's work or their agenda completely differently 5 years later.
And it does reflect the times. It is a social history with these kind of people.
Well, I'll let you say that. That's an ambitious thing for me to claim. It's certainly a very neurotic and pedantic account of people. I'll give you that.
I mean, there's such a luxury, Penny, to have 6 months. I mean, of course, as we know, it's not a full 6 months, but nevertheless, that you develop these relationships with these subjects. But is there also an excitement as well that maybe you only have 3 months, and maybe this is a quarterly venture as well?
Oh, yes.
But sort of upping the rhythm. I mean, how do you feel about
that? Have you been talking to our distributor?
Well, no. I mean, we have had your collaborators, in the form of Gerard and Joop in the building, though. But anyway, they haven't said anything.
No, people, they think we could be quarterly,
sure.
With the demand and the kind of loyalty amongst the readership. I'm enjoying the biannual experience. And to be fair, some people you can't pin down until the very last minute. So not every single piece in there has been developed over 6 months.
Sure.
It's a real luxury if you can. In the next forthcoming issue, the next one, which is September, I know that there's a couple that are nailed down already. And thank goodness for that, because sometimes if you're doing it a month, you don't have the luxury of the time. But yes, people are telling us we could be producing it much more often. And I think maybe the next step is to think about how we engage with online. I shouldn't give too much away about that. I haven't done my R&D yet, to be quite honest with you. But my background's online, so maybe one day I have to get that back out on the show, on the road.
We're going to take a very short break with Penny Martin from The Gentlewoman, and we're going to be back after this with a few more magazines.
With bureaus in Hong Kong, Tokyo, New York and Zurich, and over 25 correspondents around the world, Monocle has an experienced team of editors and journalists filing for us around the clock. From our bureau in Tokyo, Kenji Hall covers Japan and beyond.
I've kicked the tires of the Taiwanese president's motorcade, and in the span of just a couple of weeks, I've swung through more than a dozen cities across Japan, from Hiroshima to Sapporo, for Monocle's Japan Guide. The best part, though, is that I get to live in Tokyo. There's really no better city to get lost in and to mingle with world-class architects, artists, and artisans. It's a city where food and fashion are a religion, where designers like Naoto Fukasawa turn everyday products into art.
That was Monocle's Kenji Hall, our man in Tokyo.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in. From Barena jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop. Carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
And you are back with the review with me, Tyler Brulé, and Gillian Tobias here in Studio One at Midori House. It's just coming up to 14 minutes to the hour here in London. And Penny Martin from The Gentlewoman is also here. We're chatting about your new issue, which is issue number 5. But we're going to jump into the rest of the stack. And you've got Interview in front of you, the German edition. And it's interesting to see that, Interview has been around so long. It's such an iconic pop title. And, Now it's interesting to see it has a second life and almost, I would say almost been resuscitated in a way when you look at the format of both the German and Russian editions.
Mm. Yeah, it is interesting, especially when you think that of the original concept being so New York-based and so American. What's interesting if you compare, say, the current or at least the February issue of the American Interview with, I've got in front of me the second issue of the German issue with Anna Delarusso on the cover, and I assume the second issue of the Russian interview is that they've got more pages than the New York one. You'd absolutely think with a creative director like Fabien Baron that they would really have cornered the advertising market and be an incredibly fat issue, but it's extremely slim. And there's a huge amount of energy in this new German publication. I mean, I've just come from Paris Fashion Week last night, and you can really see a kind of bit of a flurry around those guys that are launching the German version on the front row, Jörg Koch and his fashion director, Klaus Stockhausen. They, of course, Jörg is the well-known editor of a much more niche art and culture magazine, O233C, named after the Pantone colour for that bright red colour. So it's quite an interesting model, really, because you're looking at somebody that on one hand is publishing a magazine that kind of speaks to the design community, and then Interview, which is obviously a much more assiduously commercial enterprise. And what I'm hearing is that Germany is just an enormous advertising market at the moment. The publisher behind it is this guy, Bernd Runge, who
unannounced. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. And he was responsible for the short-lived Vanity Fair out there. Mm. So people are saying, I mean, I'm just repeating gossip here, but why not? It's just us three.
Listen, exactly.
Is that, you know, it's sort of unfinished business for him. But but there's certainly a lot of energy, and they've got Naomi Campbell on board as a contributing editor, or perhaps she's a senior editor. I haven't looked at her title, but I gather that she's putting her back into it and wants to do all the interviews. She's making sure her address book is available, and she's rather enjoying herself. So, you know, you open it up, and it's the society pages are much more interesting and kind of a bit kind of gonzo and rough in comparison, say, with the New York one. And it'd just be really interesting to see what they do. And also, it feels that there's kind of a bit more of a female presence. The other ones I was looking at are a bit kind of boysy, but, there's a really interesting, I mean, she's an expected quantity, but there's a very interesting interview with Chloe Sevigny and Kim Gordon, you know, a kind of fairly obvious combination. But, you know, they say they're really talking about very interesting stuff about female. I just think Jörg's a very interesting editor, and he's obviously got kind of a lot of ambition. So what's interesting about these three issues is that actually they're repurposing each other's content. Obviously there's the same pieces are on the server, but it's so interesting to see the way that the layout is done in each one and what's prioritised and what's not. It's almost through the kind of degree, the calibrations and degrees of small differences that you see what the massive political implications are of these three publications in competition with each other, really.
Now, you've talked about the German team. What about who's behind the Russian edition?
Aliona, who was the editor of Russian Vogue, and indeed she's out there creating a completely different agenda, really, which is obviously much more fashion and commercial fashion. And, she's got Kate Blanchett on the cover. And when you look inside, it's a slightly different kind of, well, you know, you look at an interview and it's Mike Merry that's doing the art direction. So, you know, it's a much more masculine kind of world, whereas you can see, obviously, the Russian agenda is slightly different, you know.
And I guess, I don't know when you were in New York last, but I felt, you know, just, you know, we've been talking about it a lot since we, you know, even while we were there. We were meeting with publishers, Penny, and just, you know, just chatting to, you know, even our peer set in New York. I really feel that in the US they've talked themselves out of print. And I think just your comparison to looking at this, you know, the Russian and German editions of, you know, of Interview, and then, you know, what is, you know, quite an emaciated US edition. Mm. I mean, you just feel that's the state of print. Everyone is just so digitally focused. Mm. And it's, you know, and it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. I mean, if you think there's no future in it, well, surprise, surprise. If that mood starts to then infect the entire editorial floor.
That's very true, and these are big format magazines. There's a whole lot of magazine when you buy this publication. So, you know, I think that some of the kind of graphic innovations and things like that in the German are very exciting. And when you compare even the Russian and the American one with that kind of classical Brodovich influence, it feels a little bit deathly on the page, really.
Yeah.
It's very exciting to see this. And but what was being said to me is that, you know, it's the broad-shouldered commercial publication amongst a sea of German kind of fanzine and niche magazines, because there's so many artists and kind of interesting creative studios that are in Berlin that there's many, many magazines, and it feels like this is the one that's kind of sucking up all the advertising. But, you know, it's got a whole lot of you know, must be looking sideways at a lot of very interesting other publications in Germany.
But you know, Germany in general is such an interesting market, and you know, we've followed a lot. It's a big market for us, as it is for you. And this is a market which, you know, despite everything that's happening, I mean, it's obviously certainly the healthiest economy on this side of the Atlantic, and yet, despite all the technology, and they can buy as many tablets as they want, there is still a belief in print, and you see the expansion of book chains, and you haven't even seen the dip in CD sales in Germany.
And their newspapers.
I wondered if you were about to say that, because I've heard that often said by you, I think, is just the kind of quality of its newspaper and graphic kind of production.
Yeah, no, it's remarkable. What's next in your stack over there?
Well, at the other end, I brought in a kind of tiny another German publication called Monoculture, just because it doesn't share the same kind of production values as either ourselves, the Gentlewoman, or our interview at all. It's much more specific, but I just like the idea that these kind of magazines are about a single idea will out, you know, whereas, as you say, online is about a kind of sea of on-demand content, and it's all things to all men, and there's very little focus. And even something like interviews about sort of synthesis and about a kind of construction that can just get as many varied pieces of news and novelty together under kind of sort of some editorial vision. At the other end, there's this magazine, Monoculture, that just does one interview as a publication. I think it's quarterly.
You have to describe to the listeners what it looks like.
Well, it's A5, which means pretty much it's an A4 piece of paper folded in half. And is incredibly, it's at the other end of kind of graphic seduction, frankly. It's very techie looking. It's not got, it's got its own charm, but it looks rather kind of like a diagrammatic, like a sort of science manual. But I love this idea that such care would be taken over an encounter with one single person, and they forensically detailed them in all these little charts. This guy's Chris Ware in this one, but I believe there's been other ones with them, Tilda Swinton, etc. But I just love the sheer pleasure in one thing, and it's just so anti the internet. Absolutely, yeah.
I haven't seen a copy for a while. I also love the outside back cover, which is it sort of, well, it is a take on sort of this classical ad you get on the backs of comics.
Yeah.
Selling sort of, this is selling sort of various seeds and whatnot, but it's, this focus on Chris Ware, but it is, there's something incredibly masculine, almost reminds you of a safety card you'd find in the seat pocket.
Yes, indeed.
Of an aircraft. And I think that sort of passion and, I'm going to Berlin this week, and I just love getting into bookshops and magazine stores in Berlin, because just the energy. And I think that's, it's always it's that tension that you get between London and Berlin, which I like, that just the barrier for entry in Berlin to set up a studio, to actually get something on press, is just so much lower. It's so exciting.
I'm kicking myself because I left it in the pocket of the Eurostar in front of me last night. I don't have it to show you, but particularly because I knew I was coming to speak to you, and perhaps you never said this quote, I'm not sure, but I loved Plant Journal. There was something, somebody rephrased something they told me that you had said to them a long time ago, which was that back in the wallpaper days, that you'd launched a magazine that somebody had worked out how to be fashionable, and they knew how to pick up. But the idea was that they weren't sure about taking them home because they knew their flat was terrible, and it was about giving them that second layer of kind of sophistication.
God, I'm glad that's still sticking around 15 years later.
Well, I've got your new third tranche of that experience, which is Plant Journal, which is all about how to put plants in your house and what the kind of taxonomy and implication of what you choose. And there's this amazing magazine, I think it's into its second installment, which is all about, it does a special feature on one plant type. They've done the cheese plant, which I think is called the Mostra, and it does the cultural
surely
history.
Surely not a monthly magazine, is it?
I was looking at it, I think it's maybe biannual, I'm not sure, I haven't researched that, but then it's also got how to grow it, and there's even erotica about plants at the back of the magazine. I mean, it's literally, it's brilliant. I mean, it's not quite the design, it's got work to do on its design, I think. But the photography is fantastic, and I really believe in this magazine. One of the things that's excited me the most: how to make a soup out of all the different vegetables and how you break apart. It's just a
whole
world.
Where did you first find this?
Our art director Veronica Ditting recommended it to me. It does share some contributors with us, Daniel Riera, but I think it's coming out of Spain and London. But that's my tip. I mean, it's just it really held my attention for the entire journey back from Paris last night. It's brilliant.
We've got about a couple of minutes left. Sure. What else is there?
You showed me a whole new stack of food and home magazines that I'd not seen before.
Yeah, well, these arrived yesterday. This is Home New Zealand. It's done by ACP in Australia. New Zealand, I should say. And these just hit my desk yesterday, and I just. You know, they're very commercial. They're brought up by one of the major publishing players in the Asia Pacific region. But when I looked at them, there was just an approach to architecture, and there was a freshness to it. And these are titles that have to sell. They're very different than what we've been talking about earlier. But I was really transported to New Zealand, and I felt I couldn't be anywhere else. And I really liked them. I sat up in bed last night and I thought, okay, I'm going to go back at Easter.
Did someone send you these magazines because they heard you? The editor sent them.
I just thought they're doing a great job. I've been liking sort of New Zealand. I said, if Sweden is Australia, then I said New Zealand is kind of like Finland. Or if Australia is France, then New Zealand is Belgium. And that's what they, it's what they should be exporting. It's great.
It's certainly true that the content doesn't feel like, the press release that you've seen in every single other magazine.
And that's a challenge, I think. Don't you think with home and shelter magazines at the moment is that you just see it's the same three or four production teams around the world. Yeah. And that story is being re-syndicated 1,000 times. Mm. And so I really spend more time on the news than actually looking through things to say, God, yeah, I just want to make sure I haven't seen that before. Yeah.
They've got a big task ahead of them to deal with this advertising, because they've got a whole lot of very ugly adverts.
Bless them.
Yeah,
that is the big challenge for sure.
Absolutely, but then that will develop with them when they trailblaze.
Penny Martin, from The Gentlewoman, always great to have you here. I wish you had more than one day off a month, because we'd love to rope you into the studio.
Even more,
if possible. We're going to have to leave it there. Today's show was produced by Paul Noble, was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our sound engineer is Alex Jakes on the other side of the glass. Steve Bloomfield is going to be here with the curator in a few moments, just up next. And of course, The Weekly is here tomorrow from 11 a.m. London time with Andrew Tuck, Sophie Grove, and also Gillian DeBios. You're going to hear you again. But we have news headlines right at the top of the hour. Goodbye for now. Have a good afternoon.